This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, new figures show that in states where white people seem to be doing the worst in the job market, they are still better off than blacks, even in the best of times. There's nothing the least bit threatening about Beyoncé's latest video. And Kathleen Cleaver recounts how she joined the Black Panther Party. But first, Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific author and professor of political science at the University of Houston, has another book out. It's titled Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Paul Robeson was an NFL class athlete, spoke 12 languages, a movie star who was one of the biggest draws in the American musical theater, and was probably the best-known American in the world at the height of his popularity in the early 1940s. Yet, no more than 20 years later, the crusading artist and social activist's name had been all but erased from public discourse in the United States. How could that happen? We asked Dr. Horn.
I'm giving a talk at NYU in a few weeks on Paul Robeson and the movement for socialism that he represented. And I've been toying with the title that goes something like this, that Robeson misjudged the superpower, but it was not the Soviet Union. That is to say that Robeson has been excoriated on this side of the Atlantic, in particular because of the fact that, like the United States, between June 22nd, 1941, and September 1st, 1945, he felt that it was necessary to ally with the socialist camp in order to beat back fascist antagonists. Now, it's accepted wisdom in the United States that it was okay for FDR to ally with the Soviet Union to fight its antagonists, speaking of Nazi Germany in the first place, but it was not okay for Paul Robeson to ally with the Soviet Union to fight the lynchers and the neo-fascists in Dixie. Indeed, the turning point for Paul Robeson came perhaps in 1946 when he had a meeting in the White House with then U.S. President Harry S. Truman, a former Ku Klux Klan member, and he got in Harry Truman's face and wagged his finger and castigated and denounced the U.S. president as his face was turning purple, that is to say, Truman's face, because of Truman's lethargy in prosecuting lynchers, some of whom had been lynching black soldiers just back from the war in their uniforms, at the same time that the Truman administration was vigorously prosecuting Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg. Truman did not appreciate this comparison, and you can mark that confrontation as the point where Paul Robeson's career began to go downhill. It was not long after that the Truman administration revoked his passport, making it virtually impossible for Paul Robeson to travel abroad to make a living, sounding the same tune you found many concert halls and promoters refusing to allow him to grace their stages. And soon Paul Robeson's income plummeted from the six figures to the low four figures. He became a virtual non-person. But in some ways, Paul Robeson was a sacrificial lamb, because at the same time this was taking place in the 1950s, you may recall that the U.S. ruling elite moved to make halting steps away from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow, that is to say, Brown versus Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, May 17, 1954, which suggested that Jim Crow was no longer constitutional. Paul Robeson played a major role in helping to bring that result about because, as myself and other historians have argued, it was international pressure that forced the U.S. ruling elite to bend. The U.S. Supreme Court, which for the most part in its undistinguished history has had an unbroken record of reactionary politics, somehow found the courage to move against Jim Crow, and I think it's because of this international pressure. You see that there was a backlash against this move against Jim Crow, as represented in the riots in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, when President Eisenhower had to send federal troops into the halls of Central High School in order to enforce a judicial edict on desegregation, or in the 1970s, when you had riots in South Boston over busing of black children into predominantly white high schools. In other words, there was a grassroots rebellion amongst many Euro-Americans against desegregation, and it was international pressure led by Paul Robeson that helped to bring this result about. And it's striking to note that it was in 1950, 1951, that Paul Robeson, in conjunction with the now-defunct Civil Rights Congress led by his good friend and comrade William Patterson, that filed a petition at the United Nations charging the U.S. with genocide against black Americans. It's been only recently that the idea of going to the U.N. has had a resuscitation, so to speak, with the U.N. coming to Chicago in particular in January 2016, and with the U.N. working group basically endorsing the concept of reparations and castigating and raising questions about the U.S. approach to racism. When the United Nations came to Chicago and a number of U.S. cities just a few weeks ago, in many ways they were echoing what Paul Robeson had done decades ago, and hopefully this recent visit of the United Nations will lead to a similar positive result. That is to say, positive result for black people, certainly not a positive result for Paul Robeson personally.
Paul Robeson was such an accomplished intellect, a linguist in sports, in the arts, that he was the kind of black person that the NAACP could be expected to be most proud. And yet the NAACP participated in making him a non-person in America.
That is correct. And this was a turnabout for the NAACP, because before the advent of the Red Scare and the Cold War, the NAACP was in Paul Robeson's corner. They gave him their highest award, the Spingarn Medal. Walter White, their then leader, was fawning all over him at every opportunity. But once the U.S. ruling elite decided that anyone who advocated socialism on a serious level had to be isolated and marginalized, the NAACP flip-flopped and became one of the sternest critics of Paul Robeson. It's quite ironic. And with regard to your point about Paul Robeson's intellect, in doing this biography and doing the research for it, I still am astounded and astonished by the fact that Paul Robeson was a serious student of philology, or the construction of languages. It's said by one commentator that, for example, he began the study of Norwegian in the morning and by the evening was writing that language. He had a knowledge of Chinese. You might recall that the FBI purloined a notebook of Paul Robeson's writings in Chinese. They thought it was some sort of secret message from the Chinese Communist Party. It was actually only his working out serious questions of grammar. Paul Robeson spoke Russian. He spoke a number of African languages. He studied indigenous languages of Mexico. He read Marx in German and Lenin in Russian. This was probably the most serious intellect that not only black America, but the United States has produced to this point.
Certainly, Paul Robeson reached the highest pinnacles of all of his professions, but he dedicated his life to the service of humanity without regard to his own reputation and material possessions. Is he the kind of example that today's artists and athletes ought to be studying, looking up to?
Well, clearly. I mean, the subtitle of this book was chosen with intent and consciousness, that is to say, the artist is revolutionary. Because today, as during the era of Paul Robeson, artists, popular artists, have a lot of influence on mass consciousness. But all too often, they do not use this influence and impact for a positive purpose. And to that extent, they're going against the grain that Paul Robeson helped to create. Because Paul Robeson, as you suggested, readily relinquished the fortune, if not fame, in order to dedicate his life to the battering down of the walls of Jim Crow and the battering down of the walls of colonialism in Africa. You may know that it was Paul Robeson who was the leading force behind the Council on African Affairs, which came into existence in the 1930s and was the premier organization for years in terms of crusading against colonialism. It was Paul Robeson who befriended Jomo Kenyatta, the founding father of modern Kenya in London, who befriended Kwame Nkrumah, the founding father of Ghana, who befriended the founding fathers of Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation with its most sizable economy. And that's one of the reasons why he was heralded in Africa in particular, because they knew who their true friends were at a time when the United States, U.S. imperialism to be more specific, was the major force backing London, Paris, Lisbon in particular in their diabolical schemes to perpetuate colonialism in Africa forevermore.
And despite this lifetime of accomplishment, Paul Robeson dies in relative obscurity and relative poverty in Philadelphia.
It is something of a tragic arc of his life, the fact that a man who was once so affluent was at the end of his life not as affluent, to put it mildly. I think that if there was one flaw in Paul Robeson, it was that he was not an excellent money manager. But that also stemmed from a political instinct, in the sense that he donated so much money to political causes, to impecunious individuals. I mean, for example, Harry Haywood, you might recall, wrote a number of books, Marxist Analyses of Black America in the 40s. He was basically subsidized in his research by Paul Robeson. You may recall Louis Burnham, who was a premier Black American journalist of the left. He was the editor of the newspaper Paul Robeson started in Harlem called Freedom in the early 1950s, which featured on his staff Lorraine Hansberry, who goes on to celebrity as the author and playwright of Raisin in the Sun. Louis Burnham died prematurely in the 1950s, and Paul Robeson took it upon himself to helps to subsidize Burnham's widow and the children that were left behind when he passed, which of course included Margaret Burnham, who is now a leading lawyer in the city of Boston, and of course was a lawyer on the case for Angela Davis in the 1970s. So Paul Robeson sacrificed mightily and greatly on behalf of Black people here and abroad, and I think we do ourselves no justice when we choose to forget him and when we choose to follow the lead of our oppressors who would have cast him into obscurity and certainly tried to do so.
If Paul Robeson's reputation is to be resurrected, it seems inevitable that the reputations of other institutions and individuals of his time will necessarily suffer.
Well, certainly would have to be reexamined and reassessed. I think this is particularly true for the NAACP, which made a Faustian bargain in the late 1940s, that is to say, in return for some civil rights concessions, they chose to throw overboard not only W.E.B. Du Bois, their founder, who had come back to the staff to direct foreign relations in 1944, he was tossed overboard in 1948. So it wasn't just Paul Robeson who was treated so shabbily by the NAACP. I think of William Patterson, the Black lawyer who I wrote a biography about that came out a few years ago, who led the charge for the Scottsboro Nine in the 1930s, a case that really marked the beginning of the end for Jim Crow, insofar as it turned Jim Crow into an international issue, just like we converted apartheid into an international issue in the 1970s and 1980s in particular. The NAACP was once close to William Patterson, but when he came under fire by the U.S. authorities and the U.S. ruling elite in the 1950s, they ran and hid under their desk rather than lend him a helping hand. So certainly there needs to be an agonizing reappraisal of some of those organizations that are still around, just like we need to revive the memory of those that were not able to survive. I'm thinking of organizations like the Council on African Affairs and the Civil Rights Congress, in both of which Paul Robeson played a leading role.
And certainly Paul Robeson cannot be given his due without a focus on his international socialism.
That is correct. I find it quite intriguing that today you have a political candidate who touts himself as a socialist. Now, of course, we know that his brand of socialism does not necessarily involve solidarity with Libya when it came under attack in 2011. And if you go by the last debate in Milwaukee, Senator Sanders invoked Cold War language with regard to Moscow that would have made even Marco Rubio blush. So certainly there's socialism and there's socialism. And certainly the socialism that I admire would be the socialism of Paul Robeson. That is to say, a socialism that had at its core international solidarity, a socialism that had at its core solidarity with working people, particularly organized working people and trade unions, such as the National Maritime Union, which had been brought into being in the 1930s by his good friend and comrade Ferdinand Smith, a black man of Jamaican heritage, for a while in the 1930s and the 1940s was perhaps the most powerful black man in the United States of America, and so far as the seafarers helped to control imports and exports of the United States of America and had its hands around the jugular of this nation's economy. Certainly, his power dwarfed that of A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who is oftentimes invoked when we talk about black trade union leadership. But like Paul Robeson, Ferdinand Smith was also a man who believed in international socialism. He was a member of the Communist Party, that is to say, Ferdinand Smith was. And just as Robeson was going into eclipse in the early 1950s, you also saw that the U.S. authorities deported Ferdinand Smith back to his homeland in Jamaica. They ousted him unceremoniously. And so there is a price to be paid for the advocacy of socialism. I think that hopefully the good news is that those who are talking about socialism today, whatever their weaknesses and imperfections, might be helping to detoxify this term, at least in the minds of the naive, and hopefully can open the door to a new constellation of forces that finally in North America will benefit the struggle for peace and socialism.
Dr. Gerald Horn on his new book, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. An analysis of employment statistics shows the black jobless rate in Virginia, the state with the lowest black unemployment rate in the nation, is the same as the white jobless rate in West Virginia, the state with the highest white unemployment rate, at 6.7%. What does this tell us about the so-called economic recovery? We spoke with Dr. Valerie Wilson of the Washington-based Economic Policy Institute.
Well, I think that's just another way of depicting or demonstrating the way that race impacts economic outcomes in the country. I think we hear the national statistics and recognize that the black unemployment rate is typically twice the white unemployment rate. But when we look at it in a different way and we look across different states, because, you know, economies are vary by state, but when we look at it that way and draw that conclusion that the lowest black unemployment rate is equal to the highest white unemployment rate, I think that's another way to summarize or express how race impacts economic outcomes in this country. And it's startling. You know, we look at 6% in Virginia and compare it to the national average, that's nearly 9% now, 8.3% I think it is now. you know, we think, oh, 6.7 is pretty good then. But when you put that in the broader context of 6.7 is the worst whites are doing in the country, you more fully understand, you know, just how unacceptable those rates of black unemployment are in this country.
And that 6.7 white unemployment rate, the highest in the country, is in West Virginia. What do these figures overall tell you about black recovery after the Great Recession? Or is there a black recovery? And is there ever a black recovery relative to white unemployment?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to pull out of that when we talk about recovery. First of all, we have to consider what our benchmark are, what our standard is. So if we're considering recovery as getting back to where we were before the Great Recession, that's not necessarily a great benchmark. Because even before the recession, you know, again, the black unemployment rate was double the white unemployment rate then. And in many of those states that I outlined in the report, the black unemployment rate was above 10%. So getting back to 10%, though technically is recovery, I mean, if that were the national unemployment rate, we'd still be in a crisis. So in that sense, you know, recovery as a word and using that standard of pre-recession unemployment rates may or may not be meaningful. But then even in states where the pre-recession rate was below 10% or below the national average for African Americans, we still find, again, in those states that the black rate is double the white rate. And that statistic, that fact, you know, has been true for as long as the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been reporting unemployment rates by race and ethnicity.
And I think New Jersey had one of the lowest ratios of black unemployment to white unemployment at 1.5.
Yes. So, you know, that sort of changes a bit as we update this quarter to quarter, and it really depends on how much the black unemployment rate has changed in a state relative to how much the white unemployment rate has changed in that state. And what we saw in the last quarter of the year, there was a significant decline in the black unemployment rate in the state of New Jersey, bringing that ratio down considerably.
I'm a senior citizen, and the black unemployment rate nationally has been twice that of whites all of my adult life.
Yes, and that's the unfortunate truth that, you know, we've almost come to accept that as sort of the way that it is. And I think that's one of the dangers in finding a statistic that is that persistent and that consistent over time, is that we get to the point where we are sort of desensitized to the fact. But again, I mean, if we would look at the black unemployment rate of over 8% now, if that were the national unemployment rate, what kind of response do you think there would be? And so we shouldn't get to the point where we accept that that's okay for black America if by any other standard that high of an unemployment rate is unacceptable.
And in an economy in which almost all of the new jobs are what one would describe as bad jobs, then the unemployment statistics are not necessarily the greatest indicators of recovery.
Yeah, well, there are, you know, more than one indication of whether or not we're in recovery or how strong the economy is. The other would be in looking at wage growth. And so, again, one of the unfortunate results of not only the recession, but really we can track this back about 35 years or so. We know that wages for the vast majority of working Americans have been stagnant over the last 35 years or so. And a lot of that has to do with the types of policies that we've had in place that really have suppressed wages of the majority of workers. And you know, that's a policy issue. That's a political issue that we have to begin to address as a nation and is starting and has gained some traction among our political leaders and acknowledging that as a problem and acknowledging that as something that we have to change.
The Economic Policy Institute has also found that white workers have amassed nearly five times as much in their 401k retirement accounts as black workers have.
Yeah, so that's a finding from my colleague Monique Morrissey, who does a lot of our work here on retirement security. And, you know, that really reflects the fact that, you know, African-American households have less income than white households. I mean, it's, you know, pretty much stands to reason that if you have less income, there's less to save. But in addition to that, when we consider the ways in which people are related in a family, so again, when we sort of overlay that with unemployment disparities and knowing that the black unemployment rate is twice the white unemployment rate, if you're African American, you're going to probably be more likely to know someone or even have someone in your family who's falling on hard times. You know, if you help your family member, that again is going to take away from what you have available then to save.
And of course, if we look at the larger picture, which includes not just 401ks, but those folks who still have regular standard pensions, we see a different kind of picture.
Yeah, so share of people who have pensions has been steadily declining as, you know, we've sort of shifted into this movement towards 401ks. And I think the results from Monique's research is clear, is that that has not been nearly as effective. 401ks have not been nearly as effective at helping people to build a retirement savings and to have income security in retirement as defined benefit pensions have been in the past.
And one of the last bastions of defined benefit pensions is in the public sector, but we see that as a shrinking area of the economy, as Barack Obama likes to brag.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, fortunately, I think that's one of those examples. I was talking about wage suppression. I think that's one of the examples of sort of how we've had this paradigm shift in terms of policy and, you know, what we value or what we perceive to be important for a healthy and growing economy and how that has affected, you know, many Americans. We're shrinking public sector employment, which was a sector of the economy that, you know, historically has helped a number of people, and disproportionately African-American families in particular, to build a middle-class lifestyle. And, you know, that is under attack by people who want to paint public workers as people who are lazy or being overpaid or inefficient. All of those types of things have, you know, negative consequences for the strength of American families, working families, but also for the strength of our economy.
So as the Economic Policy Institute looks at trends, that's one trend that does not look good.
Yeah, that's definitely a trend that we would say is moving in the wrong direction, especially when we consider how drastic and how deep the recession was. You know, typically what we see when the economy is in recovery, is coming out of a recession, we actually tend to see, you know, public spending rise or, you know, more investment in the public sector to sort of, you know, undergird what's lacking in the private sector. And we saw really the opposite of that this time around, at a time when we should have been investing more. And there were investments made. I don't say that to suggest that we didn't do anything, because, you know, there was an economic stimulus plan that kept things from totally bottoming out. But, you know, the longer-term trend has been to tighten things as opposed to expanding when we really needed that additional investment.
Well, that tightening was supposed to be something that would result in expansion later on, but we haven't seen that.
Right, and I think that is a clear example of rhetoric versus, you know, what we know to be true by historical standards as well as just by, you know, simple economics.
That was Dr. Valerie Wilson at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Turkey is threatening to invade neighboring Syria, creating a direct confrontation with Russian military forces. Political analyst Eric Dreitzer, founder of StopImperialism.com, appeared recently on Russia Today's Crosstalk program. Dreitzer says Turkish President Erdogan is playing with fire.
Quite frankly, I have to say just out in the open that I am probably one of the most vocal anti-Obama critics I know anywhere on the left. And I can say this, that Obama is certainly concerned himself. I think it's quite obvious that Erdogan is to a large extent trying to use a tail wagging the dog situation where he can force the United States and force NATO into a confrontation that to a large extent, I think some of the realists in Washington are certainly fearful of. Certainly that is the word that is being implied from some of the statements in the military brass in Washington, some of the experts, former NATO officials who have said that quite openly as well. So it is undoubtedly a dangerous situation precisely because Erdogan and Saudi Arabia and some of the other allies, they have gambled and lost in Syria. The attempt at regime change has failed. And so now that they have really put themselves into a corner, rather than really admitting defeat and working for a political solution in Geneva or in Vienna or wherever it might be, they are now seemingly doubling down into a dangerous scenario. Yeah. And we have to again refer back to some of the policy establishment in Washington, which has long been talking about, quote unquote, deconstructing Syria. Yeah. Now, if that's really the case, and if they are really going to try to carve up this country and create little sectarian statelets, it will be chaos in the region, just as it has been in Libya, just as it has been in Afghanistan, just as it has been in Iraq. This reality, unfortunately, is where this is going at the best. Of course, the worst case scenario would be outright regional war, well, and Erdogan seems to be driving in that direction.
Political analyst Eric Dreitzer speaking on Russia Today. Hillary Clinton is one step closer to becoming commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces with her victory in Nevada. That's a scary thought as far as Dr. Stephen Zunes is concerned. Zunes is professor of politics and international studies at San Francisco University. He says Hillary Clinton stoked the flames of war while Secretary of State.
She was one of the more hawkish people in the administration. She was definitely one of the more hardline supporters of the Netanyahu government in Israel. And furthermore, she would try to push the United States to support the other occupation, that is, of Morocco over Western Sahara, ignoring some of the horrific human rights violations in that occupied territory. She was also backed the Bahraini regime, encouraging the U.S. to support the monarchy and its brutal repression of the overwhelmingly nonviolent uprising in that country, which per capita was the largest of the Arab Spring nonviolent uprisings. And in Yemen, when the people rose up in a largely nonviolent uprising to oust the U.S.-backed dictatorship, fellow dictatorship in that country, instead of accepting the pro-democracy movement's proposal for a broad coalition government, she successfully pushed a Saudi plan was simply transferred power to an army general who was the dictator's vice president, resulting in the series of events which had led to that country's bloody civil war. So, in fact, even putting aside the legal and moral questions about the kind of governments and policies she supported, on a very practical level, in terms of U.S. security interests and the security interests of the region, her policies have led to a dramatic destabilization of the entire Middle East and North Africa.
Most observers now recognize that virtually all of the effective fighters among the anti-government groups in Syria are Salafists of one kind or another. How much responsibility lies on Hillary Clinton's shoulders for that?
I think in Syria it's been somewhat less so. I mean, I think that if she was one of those who did push for a more active U.S. military role, I think the main problem in terms of Syria, where she does share responsibility, is, of course, in the rise of ISIS, and that was a direct consequence of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. ISIS is an Iraqi-led organization, both militarily and politically. And the irony is that she's tried to blame President Obama for not intervening enough in Syria. She said if we had bombed and gotten involved more earlier, we'd support these so-called moderate groups, we wouldn't be having a problem with ISIS. Well, not only is that highly questionable, because what limited aid the United States did give to so-called moderate groups has ended up in the hands of the Salafists, but the fact is that Obama warned back in 2002 that if the United States invaded Iraq, it would encourage the rise of these extremist Salafist groups, whereas Clinton was in Washington just mouthing Bush and Cheney's line about how we need to invade Iraq to protect us from al-Qaeda, even though Iraq had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. So she has a lot of nerve to try to blame Obama for the rise of ISIS and the tragedy unfolding in Syria when her policies have very much contributed to the very violence that's going on right now.
Hillary Clinton famously or infamously said after Muammar Gaddafi was killed in Libya, "We came, we saw, he died." In the modern history of diplomacy, have you ever heard such a statement from a Secretary of State of a major power?
It is rather extraordinary. I mean, Gaddafi, in my view, indeed, was a war criminal, and I would not oppose to him a standing trial. But to have us to defend a summary execution like that is essentially giving license to U.S.-backed rebel groups to engage in assassinations and all sorts of other crimes. So, indeed, I was pretty shocked by that. In fact, it's really interesting, during the Benghazi hearings, when she was asked about that statement, she said, I was just sharing my relief that our mission had been accomplished there. But Obama administration, you know, their official mission was simply to protect Libyan civilians from Gaddafi bombing them. When in fact she acknowledged that in fact their real policy was regime change and apparently assassination as well.
And finally, how comfortable would you be with Hillary Clinton as commander in chief?
I think it would be very dangerous. She tries to tout her credentials and domestic policies and foreign policies. She is very much a hawk. Indeed, in many ways, her thinking parallels the neoconservatives. It's not surprising that she has support from many of these notorious neocons that also advise the Bush administration. I think a real disaster. I think she, even though I've certainly been critical of the Obama administration's policies in a number of areas, he's going to come out as downright enlightened and moderate compared to what we saw, we were going to see, I think, under a Clinton administration. The very idea that here we have Barack Obama, who's bombed no less than 7 Muslim countries during his 7 years in office, being criticized by Hillary Clinton for not being militaristic enough, I think is just one sign of what we might expect under a President Hillary Clinton.
Professor Stephen Zunes in San Francisco. Ticket sales are soaring for Beyoncé's world tour. The superstar seems to have profited from the controversy over her Black Panther-flavored performance at the Super Bowl. Black Agenda Report editor Ajamu Baraka, a co-founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, says there's nothing oppositional, much less revolutionary, about Beyoncé's Formation album. He also maintains that neither Bernie Sanders nor Ta-Nehisi Coates represents a challenge to the U.S. imperial order.
The analysis is that these individuals, the Sanders campaign and Coates, are packaged as being cutting edge, as representing something that's potentially oppositional and progressive. And I make the argument that they are, in fact, fully incorporated into the grand narrative of the capitalist, of the liberal capitalist state. That even the call for reparations in the way in which it is framed and understood by many is a quite conservative call, especially if you understand that that call is being made, suggesting that the existing political system will be the system to respond to that call and, in fact, to implement reparations. And Bernie Sanders, while he talks about some very important topics in terms of the national economic situation, his foreign policies are clearly pro-imperialist, pro-empire, and consequently quite conservative. So while they are packaged as being oppositional, they are fully incorporated into the grand conservative narrative. So Beyoncé is just another one of those examples of how the system, how this capitalist state and this culture are able to reinscribe meaning, to incorporate oppositional symbols and to depoliticize those symbols and to give them a meaning that is quite supportive of the existing state of the status quo. A very powerful weapon that it employs quite frequently and very effectively. I mean, I separate the video from the actual performance at the Super Bowl. And in the video, of course, there are those images that may be new to many people. And so I don't have any necessarily a negative reaction to that. I do question how radical that really was. I mean, positive statements of blackness or what is defined as blackness is important. Her connecting up to her cultural foundations is important. It's important to deal with some of the questions around the black aesthetic. That's fine. But to read more into it than what's there, to me, is what I find a little troubling. Because we understand the power of culture. And we see that these notions of black pride, while important, can be fully incorporated into the grand narrative of the U.S. state. We saw that on plenty of occasions in the past. In particular, we look back at the so-called Black Power movement. We saw how that was incorporated by the state and was translated and transformed into a call for black capitalism. We see the messages of Beyonce in her video. She talks about and raises up in terms of putting value on being a black Bill Gates in the making. Clearly a reference to the hegemony and the importance of a capitalist value framework. She talks about if you are oppressed or exploited or whatever, that you can seek revenge through accumulating your paper, meaning money. So those messages are quite conservative. In fact, I would argue they enhance hegemony in the U.S. So therefore, there's nothing oppositional in those messages. In fact, they are quite accommodationist. This conversation and the whole Beyonce phenomenon is, in fact, framed as some kind of generational contradiction. But for me, and it may be, but I think it's more than that. I think it's a contradiction in terms of generations, but it is a cover for something much deeper, and that is a class contradiction, a politics that represents a certain kind of class, a perspective, a kind of world perspective, a value system that needs to be interrogated. Now, the fact that it's taking place with three older brothers is something that we can talk about. But part of what is happening with this so-called progressive movement in the U.S. is a kind of left McCarthyism. That is, that one is able to avoid critique and criticism based on one's professed identity, one's identity. And that, to me, is undermining our ability to get at the root of some of the contradictions, to be able to clearly interrogate what may be a faulty strategy and tactics, to expose the theoretical lack of development among those of us who are trying to push our movement forward. So we've got to unpackage this stuff because we're up against a state and a culture that is profoundly powerful. And we've got to be able to understand that if the objective is to develop critical consciousness, critical oppositional consciousness, any of these kinds of cultural phenomena that undermines that objective, we've got to expose it to ruthless criticism. But see, I don't even have an issue with Beyonce necessarily. Beyonce is what she is. She is a bourgeois artist in a bourgeois system. She's about making that paper. The issue I have is with these individuals who call themselves radicals or revolutionaries who are unable to deconstruct the obvious class politics that's involved here, who read into these simplistic cultural expressions some kind of oppositional character. You know, the influences of this postmodernist gibberish that can't separate style from substance. So I have an issue with these phonies because they're the ones that are reading into this stuff, elements that really aren't there. There are many young people who recognize that there was nothing really politically profound in the performance or even in the video. Now, we may be starved for these images people claim, which I don't really accept, but there's been plenty of positive images that we have been exposed to. What we need to have is a clearer understanding of what these things mean politically and what we are up against at this current conjuncture in history. We are facing a serious situation. And these kinds of diversionary conversations and diversionary politics only strengthen the ability of the state to continue to oppress us. I would just say that we need to be reminded of something that Kwame Ture used to always say, that the capitalist system can always offer individual solutions for what is a collective problem. Beyonce may be a powerful, rich individual, but for our people, we are oppressed and exploited by a system that needs to be overturned.
That was Ajamu Baraka on Jared Ball's I Mix What I Like program on the Real News Network. Public television last week showed the acclaimed Stanley Nelson film The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, which previously had been playing in selected theaters. Former Black Panther Kathleen Cleaver was honored at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. Cleaver recounted how she became involved with the Black Panther Party.
I was in high school in 1963, and I saw three girls on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they were on the back of a paddy wagon, and Georgia protesting the fact that blacks couldn't register to vote, and they were going to jail. And then in the story, so they were singing in jail. And I was so impressed. I said, well, these are girls. They're like me. They're in high school, and they're taking on these redneck racist police in Georgia. I mean, this is the height, to me, the height of courage. And I was in a school in Philadelphia, but I wanted to be like them. I wanted to do what they did, but I couldn't exactly go down to Albany. But that organization was called SNCC, so I wanted to be in that organization. And long story short, by 1966, I was a student in New York, and there was a SNCC office in New York, and after Stokely Carmichael called for black power in Mississippi during that march in 1966, I knew some people who knew Stokely Carmichael. I found out where the SNCC office was, and I met the new incoming director. This is black power. This is not the SNCC that I wanted to join back with the Albany movement. And I met Ivanhoe Donaldson, who had come from Mississippi to New York to take over the New York office. And we met at a party, and he said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm looking for a summer job. He said, I'm looking for a secretary. Come down to the SNCC office. Oh, this is like heaven. I got to go, and I've been wanting to get in SNCC since I was in high school. So I joined SNCC in New York, Black Power SNCC. I stayed there for about the first 5 or 6 months, and the man who I knew well as a mentor, his name was George Ware. There was a movement in Tuskegee, which is my hometown, and George Ware had been very involved as a student. He had graduated and had come and worked as a chemist in New York, and his friend, Ernest Stevens, who was also from Tuskegee and also from my hometown, who was also my boyfriend, they were all living in New York. Sammy Young, I don't know, most of you never heard of Sammy Young, but Sammy Young was an activist in Tuskegee in SNCC, and he was in my cohort of friends, and he was murdered. He was murdered because of he was murdered because he was a civil rights activist, and he was registering so many people to vote, and he was going back and forth between Lowndes County and Mississippi. He was targeted. The Deacons for Defense and Justice were protecting his home. He was a target. But the person who took him out was a Klan-type white man in a gas station where Sammy went to get something, stopped and wanted to use the bathroom, and they argued over which bathroom, you know, the ones that they used to have for black people and the ones now that were no longer black and white, but he was going to use the one that was for white people, and the man said, no, you have to use one, and they argued, and he shot him in the back and killed him. So at that point, Sammy was still in school. George Ware had graduated. He felt so guilty. He felt so responsible. He said, I can't stay up here in New York and work as a chemist. I have to go back in the movement. So he went back to SNCC in Atlanta, and he said, Kathleen, I want you to come with me. So I came down, and it was the Black Power SNCC. The whites were pulling out. The money was going away. You know, it was like really hardcore organizing. We put together a conference to explain Black Power, and the conference was in Nashville. It was supposed to be at Fisk. But because it was Stokely Carmichael and Black Power, they said, you can't be on our campus. Oh, no. So a pastor of a small Episcopal church gave us a church. And then there was the snowfall on the East Coast, and all the airports were shut down. So all these professors and intellectuals we'd invited to the conference couldn't come, except for one. And his name was Eldridge Cleaver, and he came from California where they didn't have any snow. And we met, and he said it was love at first sight. I cannot say that. But about 10 days later, I was in love with him. And he had to stay in California because he was a parolee on control. He couldn't leave the state, particularly since he came to visit Black Power people. And so I wanted to see him. I would go visit him in California, and then I'd come back to Atlanta. And at one point he said, you got to come help us. Huey Newton's been shot. This is the thing you see in the film. Huey Newton could have died, but he didn't. At the time, The only, I'd say the only adult in the room was Eldridge. Although all the men Panthers were, women Panthers were in jail, they had teenagers and Eldridge. And he said, you got to come out here and help me. And I said, when I get my tax return, because we didn't have salary, I got some money and flew out to California in November. We got married in December, and I stayed in the party all the rest of that time. So those are the way the things in the movement happen. You don't exactly plan it out. You want to be somewhere. I did want to be a revolutionary. I did want to be in the movement, and I thought I was in it in Atlanta. In fact, the people in Atlanta were very unhappy that I picked up and flew out to be with Eldridge Cleaver in California, but I was happy.
Former Black Panther Kathleen Cleaver speaking in Detroit. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, is also a renowned author. Abu-Jamal gives a boost to a former political prisoner's latest book.
Her name, Angela Davis, is known to millions still after the 60s-era uproar over her sensational trial and subsequent acquittal. For people of a certain generation, she is remembered for rocking an outrageous afro, her fist raised in naked defiance of the system. For many years, she taught at UCAL Santa Cruz and worked in the prison abolition and social justice movements. Now, today, thanks to Haymarket Books, you can read her recent speeches and interviews, speeches that address the Black Lives Matter movement, the failure of black politics, and gender struggles that are bubbling up from below. It is vintage Angela, insightful, curious, observant, and brilliant, asking and answering questions about events in this new century that look surprisingly similar to the last century. The new book, hot off the presses, is Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement. The title draws on a heartbreaking dirge from a Negro spiritual sung many, many years ago in her native South, the long, unrelenting struggle for freedom, one that still animates her. The title also reminds us of former Black Panther Kilu Niasha, who hosts a show on public radio by the same name. At times, history lesson, political education, world studies, and gender theories, Angela Y. Davis gives us all a lot to ponder.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking from the Pennsylvania state prison system. Khalil Bennett is also imprisoned in Pennsylvania. Bennett is what inmates call a child lifer, a person given a life sentence for a crime committed while he was a juvenile. The Supreme Court recently ruled that such sentences are cruel and unusual, setting the stage for the release of thousands of prisoners. Khalil Bennett says when these former child lifers are let loose, they can become the cadre of a new movement.
Are you prepared to re-embrace our elite revolutionary brothers and sisters back into society in the failed struggle after the United States Supreme Court rendered retroactivity for the juvenile lifers being held captive in America's prisons? From a dialectic point of view, some of these brothers and sisters have been detained since the late 70s and are declared bona fide prisoner of war political prisoners via whomever standards. Then a majority have sprung up out of the war on drugs, crack epidemic, hip-hop era, commonly known as the social prisoner, that were raised and trained by the best revolutionaries in the worst conditions inside either prison itself or longest stints of solitary confinement that 20th century America produced. In Pennsylvania alone, 500 juvenile lifers will wait to rush wisely back to the front lines where they are so desperately needed. Noteworthy, Pennsylvania has the most juvenile lifers. However, there are around 2,000 nationwide, so we are talking practically two small army units that will assume their position and automatically become daring leaders to the struggle, helping to move it forward at a life-saving pace. This very relevant fact is the reason why certain states fought so hard and long for over 3 years to stop the retroactive decision. Therefore, those of us that love and fight for freedom, we thank and salute you all on the outside who made this occur. Thus, more will unravel from this decision on our behalf, so I leave you all with When the prison gates open, the real dragons will fly out.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.